Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Vermont Democrat Peter Welch, who stops by for a conversation on the Farm Bill and the nation's agricultural workforce. But first, here's this week's headlines. Two companies have been given the first ever approval to begin production of cell-cultivated meat in the United States. USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service issued grants of inspection to two companies, allowing them to begin production, Upside Foods and Good Meat. This is the first time the U.S. government has approved production, cultivation, distribution, and labeling of the product. Both companies will start selling the chicken at an individual restaurant, limiting the potential reach of the products. The Environmental Protection Agency finalized its multi-year biofuel blending targets under the Renewable Fuel Standard. Overall blending was raised in 2023, but the mandates were lowered for 2024 and 2025 from what the agency proposed in December. EPA Administrator Michael Regan declared the new volumes offer long-term certainty for the RFS, but the biofuels industry was frustrated with much of the rulemaking, arguing it undercut the sector's production capacity and potential for emissions reduction. And finally, House Ag Committee leaders announced a bipartisan working group to study the labor challenges facing farmers and figure out what Congress should do to help. The group will write an interim report about the flaws of the current H-2A visa program before writing a final report with recommendations to improve it. Peter Welch is in his first term in the Senate after 16 years in the House of Representatives. It was there that he saw many attempts to fix the nation's agricultural labor issues, several of which had his support. We started our conversation by asking him what an Agricultural Committee working group could do to solve the longstanding problem in the current political environment.
Well, bottom line, we really have to have H-2A reform. It's one discrete element of the very complicated immigration battle that is ongoing. But there is bipartisan support to deal with the labor shortage. And G.T. Thompson, who I had breakfast with yesterday, I think did a very wise thing putting together a bipartisan group, 7 and 7. And, you know, whether we can do it in the toxic atmosphere that we're in, particularly around immigration, where we everything goes immediately to the southern border, we'll see. But there is so many members whose ag communities are affected, Republican and Democrat, that I have some optimism. Put it this way, it's really worth the effort. And this is a positive step. And I'm going to do all I can in the Senate to work with folks like GT to see if we can get reform on H-2A and get the labor that we need in our agricultural communities all across the country.
So, I mean, I'm not trying to be flippant with this question, but this is not exactly a new issue. We've seen this has been a top priority for many of the nation's farm groups for years. We've seen efforts on Capitol Hill, including, a couple of efforts to move the Farm Workforce Modernization Act through the House, through the Senate. I mean, I promise I'm not trying to be flippant here, but just how bad does it have to get in farm country before some of these familiar talking points will maybe be set to the side in Congress?
Right. Well, first of all, you're not being flippant. I mean, you're asking the question that farmers rightly can ask. What's up? I mean, you've got Republicans saying we need labor. You've got Democrats saying we need labor. All right, guys, get together. Get us the H-2A visas that we need. So you're not flip. You're right. And the farmers who are pounding on our doors for reform are right. And what I can say as one member of the Senate, that I hear them. And I'm going to do everything I can. The reality on this is that anytime you use the I word, immigration reform, it gets caught up in the politics of the southern border. And obviously, that's a very important issue, but it's really distinct from the labor issue that we have in farm country. So I'm hoping that more members are able to make that distinction. Let's help our agricultural community and we can continue our battle about the southern border.
Mm-hmm. One more question on immigration before we pivot to some dairy policy discussion. Obviously, we talked a lot in this conversation about the needs for producers to have that ag workforce. How do you think, politically speaking, the needs of the nation's farm workers come into the equation as legislation is potentially considered, as policies are considered? How do you think the farm workers factor in?
Well, they're connected. I mean, the farm workers, we want to make certain that there's good farm worker standards. The ag community, I believe, is on board with that. The bill that was passed through the House last year with some bipartisan support but stalled in the Senate did both. It increased the number of workers available, H-2A, but it also had some protections for the farm workers. So, you know, the farmers need workers, and they know they have to pay them right, they've got to treat them right, and they've got to get the work done. So, you know, this is a situation where the answer to the problem is right in front of us. There's no mystery here, but there's political impediments that farm country rightly is furious at. We've got to get through those.
We'll be right back to talk dairy policy and the upcoming farm bill with Senator Peter Welch right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of our space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back. Companies producing plant-based alternatives to conventional dairy milk are now subject to draft guidance from the Food and Drug Administration suggesting the companies label the nutritional differences of their products. But for folks like Senator Peter Welch, more may need to be done.
I think that the big milk labeling issue is that does milk have to be from an udder, you know, from a mammary gland? And it's really a point of pride for farmers that milk is milk, and almond, soy, and other products that people like and they can drink are not milk products. Europe doesn't label them as such. But the bottom line here is a lot of this milk labeling is an acknowledgement to our dairy farmers who, as you know, work incredibly hard. Oftentimes, generational family farms are under enormous pressure. They're entitled to some respect for the work that they do. And not only that, but for the benefits that all of us who are not dairy farmers, I'm talking Vermont now, but I'm sure this is true elsewhere, have with them being the custodians of the landscape. And all of us enjoy the benefit of their labor.
On the dairy front and pivoting our conversation toward the farm bill now, we see so much discussion in the dairy industry on federal milk marketing order reform. And I wonder, with so much attention focused in that direction on the dairy industry, they seem to be largely pleased with what was done in the 2018 farm bill to address their policy concerns. Are you expecting that industry to come to you or your colleagues with many requests in this upcoming farm bill reauthorization? Or do you think FMMO is going to be their focus rather than the farm bill?
Well, I think there is some stability in terms of the policy. There's always a challenge in terms of what the margin is for our farmers. And the cost inputs, of course, have been increasing significantly. For a period, the milk price was going up. But the bottom line always is, how do you protect when that margin shrinks or vanishes? And there's also, in dairy policy, always a big issue about the size of the farms, and we've got diversity in that. My approach on not just dairy, but ag in general, is to pay respect to what works locally in the agricultural community, because that's the unifying force. You know, Vermont has a lot of dairy, but John Bozeman has a lot of rice. I mean, the farmers that work there are as important to him as the dairy farmers are to me. And that's what gives us some, that is actually the glue that brings that bipartisan committee together, where we're trying to help agricultural communities across the country.
Mm-hmm. Wrapping up here, you're the chair of the Rural Development Subcommittee on Capitol Hill with the Senate Agriculture Committee. Wonder, as you know, you consider that committee and consider that subcommittee, what do you think is possible in the rural development front in this upcoming Farm Bill reauthorization? What are you going to be pushing for?
Well, the big thing is expanding rural broadband. I mean, you cannot have a rural community without high-speed internet. And we want high-speed internet that is future-proofed, where the infrastructure of laying lines is there so that as there are advances in broadband, that we're going to not be left behind with, quote, good enough broadband. We want it to be future-proofed. And Senator Tuberville and I on that committee are united on this commitment to just improving broadband in rural America. So that'll be a big focus of the committee. But a second thing is, you know, in the infrastructure bill that was passed, there's a lot that USDA can do to help communities, rural communities, including businesses, with energy savings efforts. And any energy that our communities can save, or our small businesses can save, or our farms can save, that goes to their bottom line. So we're going to really be promoting that as well.
Senator Welch, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel, but first, our Hannah Pegel walks us through some cost changes in a familiar nutrition program in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
An agriculture spending bill moving through the House seeks to roll back an increase in fruit and vegetable benefits for women and children in a familiar USDA nutrition program. The bill would also reduce overall funding for the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program. WIC participants receive a benefit for fruit and vegetable purchases. The House bill reduces that benefit by 56% for kids, 70% for pregnant and postpartum participants, and 69% for breastfeeding women. This chart shows annual WIC participation since 2000, as well as the cost of food during the same period. You can see the number of people in the program has gradually decreased since 2008, while the cost for food is increasing again. Despite the overall decrease in participation, average monthly participation in the first half of fiscal year 2023 was 4% higher than the first half of fiscal year 2022. USDA is considering making a COVID-19 pandemic-era fruit and vegetable benefit increase permanent, but Congress would need to agree to provide funding to cover final changes through the appropriations process. Jackie Faca has more in her coverage on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Who's the number one protein source in chicken feed? You are. Who just increased sales to Egypt by 700%? You did. Who made a huge deal with Goodyear? You again. Take a victory lap. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, you're making sales. You're making breakthroughs that all come back to your bottom line. That's you. That's who. As your soy checkoff. Moving soy forward. Moving you forward.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we are going to have a panel discussion here on the issues facing the dairy and produce sectors heading into this upcoming farm bill. Joined this week by Michael Dykes with the International Dairy Foods Association and Rebecca Adcock with the International Fresh Produce Associations. A couple of international food associations this week. I would promise we did not plan that. But Michael, going to go to you first, because before we dive into some of the farm bill stuff, obviously within the dairy industry, a lot of discussion going on right now on federal milk marketing order reform. I guess just can you give us a 30,000-foot view and just kind of assess how do you think the process is going for IDFA and its priorities to reconfigure some of those manufacturing costs for dairy processors?
Well, you know, Spencer, I would say to start with, it's been since 2008 since the last time there's been any kind of federal order hearing on milk pricing. There's been some recently stuff on transportation, but it's been 15, 16 years since that's been done. Dairy is a dynamic, evolving industry. There's been a lot of change in the dairy industry since that period of time. So pending before USDA, I think 12 different organizations have submitted 38 different proposals. We at IDFA have submitted two proposals, one to adjust the manufacturing cost allowances and one to adjust the way the Class 1 price is set, the Class 1 mover. So We are working closely with USDA. We're working across our membership. We're trying to put forth proposals that are data-driven, that are balanced, that work in the best interests across the entire dairy industry. We believe it has to be good for dairy farmers and also good for dairy processors, because to have milk production and no processing capacity doesn't work, or to have processing capacity and no milk doesn't work.
So obviously, as you mentioned, a number of different opinions on the subject, and we don't need to get into all of them and go piece by piece with them in this particular discussion. That's another topic for another date. But I do wonder, in the context of the Farm Bill, a lot of energy is being directed in the dairy industry toward this FMMO conversation, while Congress is also looking at Farm Bill reauthorization. So I mention all of that to ask you, do you think there are requests that the dairy industry is going to be able to get behind and pursue on Capitol Hill with so much of the energy pointed in the FMMO direction?
The dairy industry is united around one major piece, and that is to give the USDA the statutory authority to conduct mandatory cost surveys so that we have consistent data consistently updated across the entire dairy manufacturing industry, so that we wouldn't go another 16 years without having an adjustment to the manufacturing cost. In terms of how milk is priced, our suggestion is, with 12 organizations with 38 proposals pending before USDA, leave that to USDA Secretary Vilsack. They have a whole department of people that monitor that each day of the year, and they're experts in that, and it's a complicated process across the dairy chains.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, and Rebecca, bringing you into the fold here, because, you know, before we dive into some of the Farm Bill priorities for the produce industry, looking at the appropriations process, we do see House Republicans advancing a measure right now that includes a provision to adjust and lower the fruit and vegetable benefit under the Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. Obviously, the Senate will have something to say about that, as will the Biden administration before the president signs off on anything. But in its current form, what would that provision mean for the produce industry?
Obviously, that's a huge hit, first and foremost, to the health and well-being of the people who are using those benefits. And certainly, it does not help increase consumption or the, you know, the benefits to the produce side of the factory either. So it was something we were very disappointed to see, and we're going to continue to work on the Senate and with the ag appropriators as well on the House to help them understand, you know, the magnitude of the value that we get in investing in those products and getting those products into the hands of the people, especially the children that need them most.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
The Senate and House Ag Committees are busy working on the next Farm Bill, which will cover commodities, specialty crops, livestock, and more. This legislation will impact every farmer, rancher, and rural business for the next 5 years. Make sure you don't miss insights and analytics that only AgriPulse and its top-notch team of well-connected experts can provide. Register today for a free trial at agripulse.com and click the subscribe button, or email us at pam@agri-pulse.com. You don't want to miss this Farm Bill coverage.
Welcome back. Rebecca Adcock with the International Fresh Produce Association says the upcoming Farm Bill is going to be a critical one for the nation's specialty crop producers.
Since 2008 that specialty crops have been programmatically officially inside the Farm Bill. And that's through programs everywhere from the Specialty Crop Blanc Grant Program, the Specialty Crop Research Initiative, task map, some of the things that are in the trade space. There's several programs specifically designed or targeted or specifically included in specialty crops. And over the years, a lot of those programs have remained relatively flat, despite the fact that our presence and representation within agriculture is 44% of the farm gate. We only see 3.5% of total production, the traditional agricultural spending, goes to specialty crops. So those two numbers don't align. And what the specialty crop industry and fresh produce is pushing for is more alignment, to have the Farm Bill better reflect what food is produced and who is producing it.
So, of course, all of those priorities then going up against as we discuss a very tight Farm Bill budget. What do you think are some things that could be pursued to increase demand for fruit and vegetable products and in turn, you know, increasing fruit and vegetable consumption by consumers?
Mm-hmm. Well, we definitely have several ideas of ways that we can support through the nutrition programs. And certainly the backward movement on the AgriProps process was discouraging, but we're not giving up. And we know that there are ways of encouraging and the routes that food enters through the federal procurement program, as well as through the nutrition programs. But on the non-nutrition side of the Farm Bill, we believe that we can do a much better job finding a safety net and risk management tools for specialty crops. Very few specialty crops, except for some of the tree fruits and a few other individual products, have access to any crop protection products. And those that do have generally products that are deemed pretty meaningless.
Michael, I want to wrap up the conversation with you and maybe zoom out on kind of the Farm Bill writ large. You know, we see that the House of Representatives is currently, kind of dealing with a process of conservatives occasionally putting a blockade on any kind of action on the floor. We haven't seen a ton of, you know, real concrete legislative activity from either the House or the Senate Agriculture Committee. Don't have a legislative text from either of them quite yet. What do you think? I mean, what's your read on the progress of a Farm Bill and whether or not legislation is something that can be moved yet this year?
I know, as Rebecca mentioned, that there's an interest in reducing the federal spending, the federal deficits. But I, after being on the Hill for the last 2 days with several of our IDFA members for the legislative fly-in, I have more optimism about a Farm Bill now than I did before. There's a genuine interest and a genuine recognition that for a Farm Bill to pass and be successful, it will require a bipartisan effort.
Very good. Well, a number of things need to happen for that to happen, and we will keep a close eye on all of those things, as will Michael and Rebecca. Thanks to both of you for joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but first, our Hannah Pagel has a look at animal housing practice standards across the country in this week's Map It Out.
You may have heard of California's Prop 12 animal housing law, but several other states across the country have passed and implemented similar laws addressing animal welfare. This map shows where production practices, specifically the use of crates and cages for sows, chickens, and veal, are prohibited, or retail sales are restricted by state policies. 15 states have at least one of these policies on the books as of last year. The states have varying language in their policies. For example, Utah and Nevada have bans on using cages for laying hens. Other states like Colorado and Kentucky have bans on veal crates. And several states, including Arizona, Florida, and Ohio, have bans on gestation crates for sows. Many of the states have combinations of laws banning certain animal housing practices or the sale of products resulting from their use, creating a patchwork of regulations. As more states phase in additional restrictions in the coming years, several lawmakers are looking to the upcoming Farm Bill to pursue legislation that would halt the retail sales restrictions of products produced in other states. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Who's the number one protein source in chicken feed? You are. Who just increased sales to Egypt by 700%? You did. Who made a huge deal with Goodyear? You again. Take a victory lap. When you pool your resources through your soy checkoff, you're making sales, you're making breakthroughs that all come back to your bottom line. That's you, that's who, as your soy checkoff. Moving soy forward, moving you forward.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. The House Ag Committee is holding a Farm Bill listening session in Tennessee on Monday. USDA's Equity Commission will meet Wednesday through Friday, and Friday will bring USDA's annual report on the nation's row crop acreage. You can stay up to date with the latest news on AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.